The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are designed by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Don't waste time on apps that don't work. Babbel's conversation-based teaching prepares you for real-life situations. And studies from Yale, Michigan State University, and others continue to prove Babbel is better. One study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/truecrime. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/truecrime, spelled BABBEL.com/truecrime. Rules and restrictions may apply.
If you're like me and can still recognize Mr. Brightside from the first note, and then can't resist screaming it at the top of your lungs, you're a millennial. And if you're a millennial, it's time to add Clarins Multi-Active Cream to your daily routine. Rooted in nature and innovated with science, Clarins has a long legacy of creating industry-first, plant-forward products. Using a skin charger complex made of 2% niacinamide and sea holly bioextract, Clarins Multi-Active Cream has been clinically proven to target the first visible signs of aging by smoothing lines and wrinkles, refining pores, evening tone and texture, and strengthening the skin's moisture barrier. While Multi-Active Cream can't bring back the golden age of boy bands, it can de-stress your skin. Clarins Multi-Active Cream is available online now. Go to clarins.com/truecrime and get Multi-Active Day and Night Cream for 10% off, a free welcome gift, plus free shipping on your first order. That's clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME. clarins.com/truecrime with promo code TRUECRIME.
Story 1. The Mysterious Penturk Incident. During a cold February evening in 2016, a bewildering incident would transpire on the outskirts of Cardiff, which would in time go on to become known as the Welsh Roswell Incident. Did the British military genuinely ambush a UFO in the Welsh Valleys, or was this instead a misunderstanding of more earthly events? Join us as we delve into the mysterious Penturk Incident. The control room supervisor slipped back into the main office, having finished his cigarette break, and then made his way back across the sprawling space towards his computer. Logging back into the system, he scanned through the calls which had come in during the last 10 minutes. To his relief, it appeared the call handlers had not had to deal with anything too contentious for the brief period he had been absent. Those listed on screen were standard fare for a Friday late shift, several assaults or cases of antisocial behaviour in the city centre, and a couple of domestic incidents. Having convinced himself that there would be nothing in particular to pass on to his night-turn counterpart when he was relieved, the supervisor decided to treat himself to one last cup of coffee before the end of his shift. But he had not long been in the kitchen when one of the controllers stuck their head round the door. A number of calls had come in of bizarre activity taking place out to the northwest of the city. Several local residents were complaining of strange lights in the night sky, which were disturbing their livestock and causing some alarm. Reassuring the operator that this was most likely standard air traffic, or possibly even aircraft from the nearby St. Athan military base, the supervisor finished making his drink before heading back to his screen. But before he had managed to cross the room, one of the staff shouted across that more aircraft were now being reported. Low-flying helicopters and military transports were being seen in high numbers. Hurrying back to his desk, the supervisor quickly placed a call to the communications room at St. Athan to inquire if there was indeed a military exercise underway. Having been placed on hold by an operator, he then scanned through his emails from the previous week in case he had missed any notifications, but found nothing relating to the events being reported. Checking his watch, he saw that it was just after 2 a.m., an odd time to be conducting an exercise, especially over residential areas. Eventually, having waited some time and with further bizarre reports still filtering back to him, a calm voice came on the line. He was politely informed by the unknown speaker that the increased military presence in the area was all accounted for, and was indeed part of a prearranged exercise. But over the course of the next hour, the calls coming into the police switchboard became increasingly bizarre. One local resident had seen a squad of armed soldiers hurrying across a nearby field, apparently in pursuit of something. Another stated she had seen a huge pyramid-shaped object, covered in red lights, silently hovering near her home. But by far the most worrying was the report of an explosion in some nearby woods, followed by an Apache helicopter crash-landing in a farmer's field. During the course of the evening, the police control room would struggle to cope with the volume of reports it was receiving, leading to several more frantic calls to their military counterparts in an effort to query what was taking place. Each time they were given the same response. There was nothing to worry about. All of this was pre-planned, and that everything would be back to normal by the following morning. But nothing could have been further from the truth. The strange events which allegedly took place in and around the village of Penturk on the evening of the 26th of February 2016 would not pass unnoticed by the media. Several articles were published after the incident on local news websites, featuring accounts from some of the witnesses, as well as formal responses which were obtained from both the police and the Ministry of Defence. There were also several follow-up pieces, which made their way into national news outlets, with the more spectacular witness accounts concerning the incident reproduced as part of a wider analysis of British UFO incidents. But many who resided in Penturk felt that their voices were intentionally being silenced, and that in some cases, their accounts were deliberately undermined in order to invalidate their reports. It appears evident from the sheer volume of calls received by the police control room in Cardiff on the evening in question that something unusual did indeed take place in the skies over the region. And it seems equally clear that the residents contacting the authorities were utterly convinced that what they were witnessing was not of this earth. One of the first callers to contact the police that evening was a local man named Mike Henbury. He reported having witnessed a series of pulsating red spheres. These went on to align themselves into the shape of a triangle, which then slowly descended from the clouds. Henbury had watched on in wonder, as this large pyramid-like object had come to a halt about 10 feet above some nearby fields, before going on to disgorge a series of smaller red and green orbs. These orbs began to dance around, just above the ground beneath the hovering craft, before then merging into a larger sphere, which continued to emit bright pulses of light, alternating between red and green. Henbury's statement is perturbing enough, but even more so when viewed in conjunction with the account of the main witness to the evening's events, a local resident by the name of Kaz Clark. For Clark, the incident in Penturk had begun 3 days earlier on the 23rd, when she and one of her friends noticed military planes circling the area. For the next 2 days, she continued to see unexpected aircraft in the skies above her village, both during the day and the hours of darkness. Then, at around 2 a.m. on the 26th, She was in her back garden with two of her neighbours when they were disturbed by a loud drone in the skies overhead. Looking up, they saw a large military jet, an E-3 Sentry, with what appeared to be a circular radar dish rotating above it. They watched on as the plane began to circle the area, apparently searching for something. It was then that they became aware of a vivid crimson light, slowly descending over some nearby woodland. Clark and one of the neighbours decided to move in for a closer look. As she and her companion continued to observe, this light broke apart into a series of smaller, glowing red orbs, which began to align themselves into a roughly triangular formation. The space between these orbs suddenly darkened, the night sky behind them disappearing, as a massive pyramid-like craft seemed to materialize out of nowhere, framed by red lights. From their vantage point, roughly 200 yards away, the two witnesses watched as the pyramid gradually began to rotate on its axis. At the apex, a bright green object was ejected at great speed, which took up position hovering in the night sky a short distance away. Whilst this was happening, a series of what appeared to be lightning bolts issued forth from the lower far corner of the pyramid, which seemed to be striking the ground beneath it. These bursts of light were so intense that they backlit and illuminated the sheer size of the craft hovering above. More orbs were ejected from the top of the pyramid as the military jet continued to circle overhead. These new lights appeared to dance and mingle with one another, as if protecting the main craft. As Clark and her friend looked on, a number of additional aircraft soon arrived to join the E-3 Sentry. After conducting some research, Clark would later go on to identify these as Hercules and Globemaster military transport planes. The new arrivals, which numbered four in total, formed up on the E-3 Sentry and then began to circle the pyramid craft, in an apparent attempt to hem it in. At this point, two things occurred. The red lights marking the outline of the floating pyramid initially dimmed, and then disappeared, with the larger craft also vanishing from sight. At the same time, the smaller green object which had been hovering nearby flared brightly three times, before setting off at speed away from the location, bobbing and weaving as it went. Clark and her friend observed the progress of this green orb as it led the pursuing planes away and off to the west, varying its speed and course until all of them had disappeared into the night. Shortly after this, two smaller objects which were red in colour appeared from the right side of the field. One of these paused overhead, appearing to scan Clark, before it then turned green and moved away. Over the next hour, the skies above Penturk were filled with yet more activity. Other witnesses reported seeing unknown objects, which were in turn chased away from the area by a group of Apache gunships, before all activity finally ceased. Clark and her friend decided to venture out into the field where the pyramid had been hovering, in search of any physical evidence, but frustratingly, there was nothing to be found. Roughly half an hour later, after they had returned to Clark's address and were discussing the events they had witnessed, the pair were startled by the sound of a distant explosion. They realized it had come from the west, the direction in which the military aircraft had been chasing the green object. She quickly formed the opinion that it must have been shot down. The following morning, with the entire community discussing the previous night's events, Clark asked her friends and neighbours if any of them had heard the explosion. Several other witnesses stated that they had, some even reporting two separate explosions in close succession, the first of which seemed to have come from the skies above, and the second from the ground, in the vicinity of the nearby Clantrissant Forest. Clantrissant Forest is a 600-acre woodland, known locally as Smilog Woods. Determined to find out if her theory was correct, Clark immediately set off towards the forest. Upon her arrival, it did not take long to locate signs of an apparent impact. Sure enough, deep in the woodland, she found a debris field of countless trees which appeared to have been splintered or shattered, as if recently impacted from above by a heavy object. Bizarrely, it also seemed to be snowing, but only in the local vicinity of the damaged trees. That same day, Clark also visited the area where the lightning bolts from the pyramid-shaped craft appeared to make contact with the ground, expecting to find the grass there burnt. Whilst there was no obvious damage, she did find that all plant life in the immediate vicinity appeared to be dying. Again, it was snowing, but only inside the field. Clark states that to this day, nothing grows in this area, and that it has become known as the Bull Patch. Military personnel were also witnessed on the outskirts of Penturk, who, when questioned, told passers-by that they were performing training exercises. But when plain-clothed civilians suddenly arrived and camped out in the fields behind Clark's house, they gave conflicting reasons to local residents as to why they were there. Some witnesses were told by the outsiders that they were a fracking survey team, whilst others were informed that they worked for a cellular network. The authorities also enforced unexplained road closures in the immediate aftermath. The reason given was due to an overturned lorry, but the number of highways that were closed, which included the M4 motorway, seemed excessive. Clark has spent the years since her encounter searching for evidence which might validate her account. She has revisited the crash site with local UFO enthusiasts, who claim to have detected what appear to be very high levels of electromagnetic radiation. Using the Freedom of Information Act, she has also produced evidence from local air traffic control outlets, as well as geological and seismological data, which she believes supports her account of the night's events. She has produced witness testimony from residents as far afield as Port Talbot and Swansea, who say they observed objects that evening, which were similar to those sighted above Penturk. They state that the explosions were so powerful that it shook their houses. Patients in a nearby hospital claim that the sheer intensity of the blast shook them awake in their beds. But despite the efforts of Clark and other local residents, the authorities continue to dismiss her findings, stating that what she and her companions witnessed was simply a military training exercise. What makes the Penturk incident stand out from the majority of other alleged British UFO encounters is the sheer volume of the people involved. The southwest region of Wales is no stranger to reports of strange lights moving around in the night sky, but these are usually isolated incidents, with only one or two witnesses. On this occasion, an entire community was affected, to a degree where a significant number felt the need to request urgent assistance from the emergency services. Are we really to believe that all of the witnesses involved were simply mistaken or confused about what may have been nothing more than a simple military training exercise? Commentators on the incident believe that the answer to that question is a resounding yes. They dismiss the more fantastic elements of the witness accounts, citing aspects of mass hysteria and attention-seeking, and point to what they believe are more tangible facts. Wales is home to a large number of significantly sized military installations, and the incident occurred around the time of a biannual military training exercise named Operation Chameleon. The Ministry of Defence purport to be quite open in describing the practices which take place during these drills, applying for no-fly orders in advance of the whole exercise, and listing all their training practices on their website in the aftermath. Observers state that the red and green objects described by witnesses were most likely drop zone markers, and the lines of light in the sky believed to be the outer edges of a large spacecraft were likely descending paratroopers. For the purposes of the exercise, each of the soldiers involved would have been wearing a light on their gear to indicate their position to the rest of their unit. To a member of the public, seeing several straight lines of red or orange glowing lights descending slowly from the sky, it might be possible to mistake their alignment for the edges of something large hovering above. It would also not be unusual for aircraft to be simulating crash landings, or for soldiers to be moving around with their weapons on open display. But for Clark and many of her fellow witnesses, such arguments represent a classic government cover-up. First and foremost amongst the alleged contradictions is that Operation Chameleon took place a week before the Penturk incident and was situated in the north of England, not Wales. Secondly, nobody knew anything about any pre-planned exercise. Not the police, not the local government, not the media, and most importantly, not the local residents. No one had been informed of any such manoeuvres, which itself is a huge red flag. Before any military exercise involving aircraft, a NOTAM, or Notice to Airmen, must be issued in order to warn commercial and civilian pilots not to enter the airspace, to prevent mid-air collisions. NOTAMs are usually raised well in advance, but in the case of Penturk, one was not issued until 9 p.m. on the 25th, mere hours before the alleged exercise. Not to mention that the boundary of this NOTAM was exceeded by over 50 miles, something that would never happen because it would endanger other aircraft. In any case, the idea of conducting such a high-intensity drill at low level over a residential area at such a time in the morning is almost inconceivable. Not just because of the obvious disturbance, but because of the very real risk of causing an accident. Clark was right below the alleged drop zone and categorically states that no soldiers or parachutes were present in the field when she and her friend went to check. No paratroopers were deployed that night whatsoever. The soldiers witnessed on the ground fast roped from helicopters over Llantrisant Common. Elsewhere, the military continues to deny that any explosions occurred, despite seismological data confirming otherwise. Finally, many witnesses state that what they saw was a real physical craft, not just an outline depicted by lights, which in any case were far too steep in orientation to be armed forces parachuting into the area. Kaz Clark has resolved not to give up her quest to uncover the truth, and continues to submit Freedom of Information requests to local organisations in search of evidence which supports her account. Since she first came forward, she has successfully passed three separate polygraph tests conducted by the leading government examiner, and reports that she and her family have also received threats against their lives for speaking out. Whilst the arguments for the Penturk incident being a prearranged military exercise are somewhat plausible, when viewed in context, it would have been completely out of character for the British Armed Forces. The commonalities in the testimonies of local residents do make their stories compelling. The very fact that so many were upset by the commotion proves that this was completely unplanned and unexpected. This is truly an interesting case with many complexities. Unfortunately, too many to mention in the space of this episode. For those who would like to hear a more detailed depiction of events from Kaz Clark herself, we recommend watching the excellent video put together by the Paranormal Scholar, which we will link in the episode description. In time, it is possible that the efforts of those who continue to investigate aspects of this story may pay off, and the truth behind what occurred in the skies above this quiet Welsh village may finally be presented.
We'll be right back.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress-them-on-the-third-date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Story 2. The Howden Moors Incident. In March 1997, the authorities responsible for policing the UK's Peak District were forced to initiate a high-profile search and rescue operation. Local residents reported seeing an unidentified aircraft hurtle from the skies and impact a remote area of moorland. No survivors or wreckage pertaining to this incident have ever been officially recovered, despite numerous witnesses having observed it taking place. What was the true cause of the Howden Moors incident? In previous episodes, we have discussed the uneasy relationship between the Royal Air Force and the phenomenon of UFOs. In recent times, military authorities in the United States of America have gone public with official footage of alleged encounters between their pilots and extraterrestrial craft. This has generated global interest in such cases, handled via a very firm but polite response, that those involved had no knowledge of what they had engaged. On the opposite side of the Atlantic, the United Kingdom's armed forces have continued to adopt a far more guarded approach in relation to such matters. This can be seen in their response to the events at Rendlesham Forest in 1980 and the incident which took place near the Welsh village of Penturk in February of 2016. Their replies to inquiries from the public and media seemed to initially feign surprise, followed by a somewhat aggressive denial that the incident had ever taken place. And yet, witnesses to purported UFO incidents in the United Kingdom have time and again observed military aircraft and personnel actively involved, conducting ground searches and restricting public access to the scene. This would certainly prove to be the case in the aftermath of a sequence of events which began to unfold on Monday the 24th of March, 1997. It all started in the control room of Ecclesfield Police Station in Sheffield, just after the radio operators working the night shift had settled down at their stations. At approximately 10 p.m, a call was received from an 81-year-old resident wishing to advise the police of a strange incident she had just witnessed. The caller in question explained how she resided in a rural property in Stannington, a small village which was located on the outskirts of Sheffield. The woman then relayed to the call handler how she had been getting ready for bed when she had noticed an unusual light moving through the sky. Walking across to her bedroom window, she made out a strange aerial object, travelling slowly in the direction of the Strines Reservoir. This craft was unlike any plane or helicopter she had seen before, being cylindrical in shape with no obvious method of propulsion. The object was even more disturbing as it appeared to be a flame, generating a bright orange glow which seemed to flicker and dance across its surface. Having thanked the witness for her call, the operator had duly logged the report with his supervisor, who would evaluate it and then determine the most appropriate response. Perhaps understandably, The initial assessment of the woman's call suggested that it did not warrant police attendance. National radio stations and other media outlets had been informing their listeners and viewers for days now that tonight would be the best time to view an expected cosmic event. This would be one of the few evenings where the weather might allow UK residents a clear and unimpeded view of the Hale-Bopp comet as it passed by close to Earth. 15 minutes later, a further report was logged by another of the duty operators, which then caused the previous assessment to be reviewed. This call had originated from two farmers who were out working in their field, which was situated near the village of Bolsterstone. They were reporting a similar incident, having briefly observed a low-flying aircraft of some description before it had disappeared at speed over the horizon. A short time later, the pair had seen a bright flash from the same direction, followed by what appeared to be several plumes of smoke rising into the sky. When asked to estimate where the smoke was originating from, the witnesses stated that they believed it would be near to a remote patch of moorland known as Marjorie Hill. Their testimony was still in the process of being evaluated when there was a sudden flood of phone calls into the switchboard, all reporting similar information. Amongst these callers were Sharon Aldridge and her friend Joanne, who were camped out by the Strines Reservoir, hoping to catch a glimpse of the passing comet. It had been a freezing cold night, the sky completely cloudless, when the pair had suddenly been disturbed by an unexpected and loud buzzing noise. Craning their heads this way and that, they were unable to locate the source of this sound, until a large black object had suddenly hurtled through the sky directly above them. This object was descending rapidly and moving at such speed that they were unable to make out any details which might have identified it as an aircraft. The sound it made was unlike anything either woman had ever heard, not resembling a plane engine or the rotors of a helicopter in any way. The speed at which the object was falling prompted the pair to abandon their viewpoint and drive to the nearest public phone to report what they believed to be a plane crash. Their report coincided with another from a local gamekeeper named Mike Ellison, who was calling from his home only a short distance from the Strines Reservoir. Ellison had been sat watching television with his wife when their relative peace had been shattered by what sounded like a massive explosion outside. Hurrying to his front door, Ellison had scanned the skies around his cottage for any sign of what might have caused the thunderous commotion, but could see nothing. Just then, he became aware of a bright orange glow on the horizon, emanating from a point several miles away, in the vicinity of Hope Valley. Ellison described this light as being consistent and steady in nature, very different to the strobing or transient effects he would have recognised as passing vehicles or aircraft. He and his wife were shortly joined by a neighbour who had been disturbed by the same noise, and was also observing the mysterious glow on the horizon. All three were convinced that what they were witnessing was the aftermath of a significant air crash, with something having impacted the ground a short distance from their homes. Assessing the volume and similarity of the phone calls she was receiving, this hypothesis was shared by the police duty incident manager, Chief Inspector Christine Berberi. By 11 p.m. that evening, Berberi had initiated South Yorkshire Police's formal response in the event of a plane crash within the boundaries of their jurisdiction. Over the next 15 hours, more than 200 personnel from a variety of emergency services and charities would be involved in the search for the downed aircraft. On the ground, police and mountain rescue teams divided themselves up into groups and began to make their way out onto the moors, along their agreed search corridors. Behind them, fire brigade personnel and ambulance staff formed up at their designated rally points and prepared to follow in the event that casualties or wreckage were located. Alongside this, queries were raised with local airfields, including the control tower at Manchester Airport, asking for any details regarding the missing plane and who might be aboard. But these inquiries would prove as futile as the physical searches, and with nothing having been found by 2 p.m. the following day, the operation was reluctantly wound down. Any hopes that some degree of clarification might be forthcoming during the coming days, however, would not be realised. Instead, the only evidence that came to light over this period would prove to be as perplexing as the initial incident itself. The extent to which RAF personnel were involved in the Howden Moor search operation continues to remain a subject of debate. According to official records, which were later obtained via a Freedom of Information request, they provided very limited resources in the search. A Sea King helicopter based at RAF Leconfield had been dispatched to support the aerial search, but that was all. Beyond this, the only other time RAF personnel became involved was to satisfy police inquiries in relation to radar evidence. Their official response was that the radar facilities at the nearest airbase, RAF Linton-on-Ouse, were not manned overnight and had therefore not been recording at the time. And yet, numerous witnesses who were spoken to by the media in the following days reported seeing a whole host of RAF resources in the vicinity. Several calls logged during the late-turn shift prior to the crash being reported referenced seeing an unidentified military helicopter moving in and around the local area. More concerning still, several witnesses insisted that they had seen other RAF aircraft directly involved in the build-up to whatever had taken place on the moors. A driver on the nearby A61 bypass and a local youth team training at a football pitch in Dronfield all reported seeing three fast jets streaking across the sky. Their accounts would be corroborated by a retired RAF officer named John Brassington, who had been disturbed in his Derbyshire home by the sound of jets. Brassington was able to positively identify the planes as RAF Tornadoes, having worked alongside such aircraft in the past, directly undermining the account of his prior employers. There is also the testimony of gamekeeper John Littlewood, who had been out in his vehicle on Midhope Moor at around 10 p.m. on the evening of the incident. He witnessed a very large transport aircraft with red lights at the outer edge of its wingtips, flying slowly and at low altitude over the moor. This multi-engine plane was similar in size and shape to an RAF Hercules and was gradually descending as it approached from the direction of Stocksbridge. The fact that a no-fly zone was enforced around the area for several hours during the rescue effort prompted some commentators to accuse the RAF of a cover-up. They alleged that this would have allowed military personnel to enter the scene without the knowledge of the authorities, possibly to recover bodies and debris. The reasons for these covert actions were either because the crash plane was one of their own, or that their pilots were in pursuit of an unidentified object, which they then forced down onto the ground. Even without data from the large number of RAF stations that would have been monitoring the skies that evening, there is evidence to support that a crash did indeed take place. Records obtained from the Edinburgh-based British Geological Survey reveal two significant seismic events having been recorded near to Howden Moors at the time. These were consistent either with a ground-based explosion or the sonic boom of a fast-moving aircraft travelling overhead. This would again seem to suggest that the RAF may have had reasons to deliberately underplay their involvement in the official record of the incident. When reviewing the entirety of the reports logged with the police on the evening of the alleged air crash, the witnesses divide neatly into two groups. Half hold firm that what they saw was a light aircraft, complete with conventional navigation and landing lights, with a single propeller mounted on its nose. Others insist that it looked nothing like a conventional aircraft, instead being a wingless object, illuminated by an otherworldly glow. Shifting away from conspiracy theories suggesting that the UK's armed forces were involved in a dogfight with an alien craft, alternative explanations have been proposed. Perhaps the most obvious is the possibility that people were seeing the Hale-Bopp comet, which so many had been outside hoping to catch sight of. Their perceptions might have been skewed by the vastness of a clear nighttime sky, along with the light emanating from nearby industrial estates, and later, the lights of the search operation. There have also been historic reports of civilian aircraft acting suspiciously over the moors, believed to be linked to criminal gangs operating in nearby Manchester. It is entirely possible that such a flight, consistent with almost half the descriptions offered by witnesses, crashed in the act of dropping or retrieving a consignment of illegal drugs. Such wreckage would not have been immediately obvious to the search teams, as it may have crashed into one of the 13 large reservoirs situated on the moors. There is also the possibility that this mystery plane had ditched in one of the many patches of bogland which dot the local area. Wreckage and even bodies relating to previous air crashes across the region have been lost in this way, sucked deep into the moor's boggy surface. There are also reports that a male had been detained by police at the time, suffering from what appeared to be severe burns, wandering near the Lady Bower Reservoir. South Yorkshire Police denied allegations that this may have been an injured tornado pilot or a drugs runner who had survived a crash. Apparently, a man had driven to the moor, doused himself in petrol in a failed suicide attempt, and subsequently sought medical attention from the authorities. Viewing all the evidence in its entirety, one can't deny how compelling the arguments are that some sort of air crash took place within the Peak District during March of 1997. Whilst there is little doubt that the local authorities have been transparent in their involvement, questions linger over the RAF and their official version of events. It's possible that evidence may still be lying somewhere out in the solitude of the region, waiting to be found, and that such material could finally clear up the debate that still rages over what took place one cold and lonely night in the skies above Howden Moors.